This is CliffCentral.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Opinion Booth with myself, Sonia Booth. And those two songs were a tribute to my guest who's on her way here today. Today's title, today's topic is Beauty and the Brain. Once I've uploaded her picture and the podcast on our website, you'll get to see why the title. An incredibly intelligent woman. I'm going to ask her about her IQ level when she gets here. Her name is Dr. Thabi Leoka. She's an economic strategist, contributor to various local and international publications, which include Money Marketing, Sunday Times, and BRICS Post. Those obviously have got to do with the economy and all things economics. She was recently honored with the Economist of the Year Award by ABSIP, which is the Association of Black Securities and Investment Professionals. Now, I know Tabby's listening to the show as she's driving here from a very, very important meeting. As you know, economists are very busy at this particular point in our lives. When you look at the economy of our country, after all, we are junk status. But I mean, that's for Tabby to break it down for us as soon as she arrives here. She should be here in about 5 minutes. So, what she doesn't know, and obviously now she's going to know because I know she's listening, is that a surprise for her is that I got two of her closest friends, Pumla and Pamela, to record messages, positive words of encouragement, and to try and get us to know Thabi as they know her, and the rest of us know her as Dr. Thabi Leoka. Well, I'm close enough to call her Thabi. But let's listen in to voice notes from Pumla and Pamela.
Hi, Sonia. Molo Thabi. This is Pam Pitty from Mthatha. Thank you for having me on your show, Sonia. I met Thabi back in high school 25 years ago. For as long as I have known Thabi, she has always been ambitious, focused, and hardworking. Not only is she super intelligent, what people may not know about Thabi is that she excelled in sports in high school. Thabi could have been an equally accomplished sportswoman. What I love the most about Thabi is that despite all her accomplishments, all her world travels, she has not lost herself. She is not jaded by life at all. Thabi remains humble. She lives life to the fullest. She's fun-loving. There's nothing superficial about Thabi. What you see is what you get. From New York to Iran to Kunu, from sports field, social gatherings, to boardroom, to parliament, Thabi remains grounded. As a mother to two young girls, I can only hope they and many other young women and girls like Thabi can understand the value of hard work, humility, and that whatever they set their mind to, they can accomplish without compromising who they are.
Hello, Sonia and Thabi. This is Pumla. I'm calling in from Brooklyn, New York, which also happens to be Thabi's favorite city. So I've known Thabi for a long, long time. I mean, I met her in high school. That is St. Cyprian's High School back when we were young. For her to be on this platform that she's sitting on today, I must say I'm extremely proud of her. I'm proud of her to call her my friend, and I'm also proud of the hard work that she's put through her life to be where she is. So for all the young girls out there, she's a very good example of what it is to put in work and what you achieve at the end of it. Like, you can't expect to wake up one day and have everything that you want to achieve, which is whatever it may be in your field, which is your career, in order to achieve money and status. You have to work hard at a career. She's always been a very focused and very determined person, especially when it came to her career, to be able to move forward and be where she is. And she's worked a lot in a very male-dominated and very cutthroat industry where you have to know what you're doing. And she's been able to succeed and be where she is. Anyway, that's just my brief note about Tavi. I wish I could be there with you guys. And thanks for having me on the show. Bye.
Oh, that's so sweet.
I know. Pleasant surprise, obviously.
Very.
Look, she's blushing. All the way from Brooklyn.
Thank you, Pamela. That is so, so sweet.
Did you get to hear the one from Pamela as well?
Yes. Okay. Pam. Ah, that's so, so sweet.
Ladies, Pamela, if you're listening, I know you're listening, but you've made a woman blush today. And I mean, to make someone of Tavi's caliber to blush is not an easy feat. I asked her to give me her top five favorite songs, and I can't say I was surprised at the list. As you've heard from a few that I've played, each different from the other, and clear indication of a global citizen. Dr. Tavi Leoka, welcome to Opinion Booth.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I know you rushed here, right?
Rushed. Yeah. But I made it.
I know. I'm so happy. I am so happy. She rushed from a very, very important meeting. I know you are hectic. I know your schedule is like ridiculous. And I know that you spend more time outside of South Africa than you do here in your own country. So you listened to the show as you were driving here. I remember the modeling days.
Mm.
She would sit quietly in a corner waiting for her turn at auditions. She always had her books and textbooks. Even between rehearsals for a fashion show, she would sit between clothing rails and study while the rest of us were on our phones or talking nonsense or gossiping. You knew she was destined for greater heights. She wasn't your typical model. She kills the stereotype and perceptions that models are dumb. Do your colleagues know you were a model, or do you wish that part of your life would just evaporate or erase from
your profile? So not many people know, but I don't wish it away. I think that it was a very important part of my upbringing. Modeling actually paid for my undergrad, and then I got a scholarship for my honors and masters. It also helped me with my confidence. I was actually very shy, and believe it or not, because I'm not anymore. I was very shy up until I think I was 25. And so it gave me self-confidence. I've always loved fashion. So I think it tapped into that part of me. I love fashion. I love clothes. I still follow a lot of models on Instagram. And I like the way, I guess models interpret fashion differently. Whether fortunately or unfortunately, it works for me because I'm actually, I'm on the more on the small side. But it helped me also understand how to put clothes together. And so that's why I love following models. I love clothes. I love shopping. And I guess, I've always thought, yes, I'm an economist, and yes, I studied up until, PhD level, but we do always stereotype people, and we think that you are one thing and your route is just one directional. And I think the best people for me, even from friends, are those who've had a different lifestyle and have a different background to mine, and have experienced many things in life. I think that they are more interesting, so they can talk about how they were artists and then how they ended up here as whatever they are in life, or their journeys are interesting. And those who've just had a linear journey, those ones tend to be a little bit more boring and more normal, and their contribution to I guess life is very singular.
You are not a typical economist. I'm sure you've heard that before. No offense, but a lot of economists, just like accountants, are known to be on the stiff side. Like they're too serious. They take themselves too seriously. And I laugh when I read your Twitter bio. And it goes on to say, tweets, like my brain, in brackets, are my own, not that of my employer. I love your sense of humor. It's refreshing to find an academic of your caliber with a great sense of humor.
Yeah, it goes back to, you know, we're all, I guess, different. And I think I'm loving the younger generation, too, because I'm coming from a generation where you don't have to be dull and a boring economist to be an economist. You're many things. On weekends, when it's hot, you can wear your hot pants and a vest and go to downtown Maboneng. That doesn't mean that you're not an economist. And I guess also, I think it's a very South African thing that people associate what you do at work to who you are. And I'm so many other things. So work is work, and my profession is my profession. But there's so many other things that I enjoy and that I am, and I express that a lot.
I mean, you are so well accomplished. I mean, I'm sure your CV or profile is probably like going over 50 pages, right? No. It's probably like a book on its own. You started out with a BA in Honours in International Economics and Trade from Wits University,
yeah,
where you graduated first class and were a recipient of a merit award. You went on to graduate with a UK Masters in International Economics. You have a Masters and PhD in Social Science, majoring in Economics from the London School of Economics.
Yeah.
How does it feel to be referred to as doctor? Tell me about that moment where people, when they referred to you, had to write doctor before yeah. your name, and when you book in, when you check in at the airport, and you know, some of us just have normal names and no titles before our names. But then that moment when you first saw doctor on a letterhead or business card.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So when I started in undergrad, I actually almost failed. I was almost kicked out of Wits, and they had to call my mother to say, look, the two of you justify why we should allow you to do first year again. And what happens is that you take some courses that are first year that you've passed, and then so you take first year courses and some second year courses that you've moved on to. And so I didn't have the best academic results. It's only later on that I thought, actually, this academia thing is you know, it's working out. I guess also my maturity too, and how I started looking at school in a different way versus maybe when I was first year and I socialized more. I sat on the lawns and on the Senate House staircase without actually going to the library and doing my work. And so the higher I went, the better I got. And funny enough, you have to ask my mom. She'll tell you that after my first degree, I said, actually, just before my first degree, I said, I'm never setting foot at a university again. This is it. I'm done. And then I got a good grade, and I thought, okay, maybe let me do an honors, and then let me do a master's. And I kept on getting higher and higher grades. And the other strange thing about, so I got a first class pass for my master's, and when you get a distinction, the government actually gives you money. So I didn't know this because I worked for a while and then I went to London. So I only went to one graduation. I was just like, okay, this ceremony thing is very boring. And so I later found out, like much later on, that two years ago, I found out that I have I was awarded with a merit award, and that's because I didn't go to my graduation. I didn't know that I was given a merit award, and then I got money, and I got the check 2 years ago, January, from like almost 20 years ago.
Wow.
From Wits.
Okay.
Yes. So, so that's my academic story. Then, you know, at LSE, was also very challenging, very great experience. But then I started working at Barclays afterwards, and everybody had a PhD in my team. So the novelty kind of wore off because it almost was like a standard. And, most economists overseas don't use the doctor name. And again, I always, during my studies, I always thought to myself, look, everyone is going to call me doctor. And I remember even saying, when I get married, I'm going to be like doctor and mister, you know. And then, and my friends would laugh because I would be the doctor marrying the mister. And then it just kind of wears off. once you finish your degree, you're like, actually, that doctor thing is not really used, and I find it quite uncool. Every time I see somebody using the doctor, I was like, that's very, I guess, an African thing to do, because everywhere else, you know, Ben Bernanke, who was the governor of the Fed, is Ben Bernanke, and Janet Yellen is Janet Yellen, is not doctor, or all the great economists are never doctor so-and-so, unless they're in academia where they're doctor or professor.
That talks of your humility, I think. Personally, I would insist that everybody refers to me as doctor, even my close friends. It's like,
oh, no.
I've earned it. It wasn't easy getting a PhD, sweetheart. I insist on doctor.
But also,
booth.
You know, you've got the medical doctors who are not the PhD doctors, because it's always, we always have this thing that I always tell the medical doctors that you're not the doctor, actually, until you, because with medicine, you can also study PhD in medicine,
yes.
And then you're a doctor.
Yes.
So the doctor is the term that they use for people who are in that profession. So I always say, no, you're not the real doctor, we are. But I guess it's, they usually use the doctor name, and it's also quite confusing, because even I use it only in certain places. So when I book an airline ticket, then I would say doctor, and sometimes it works, sometimes they like bump you up
first class, because we all know fly business class, right?
Not really. And then they also bump you, like in certain events where it is, I guess, useful to use doctor, then I'd use it.
To your advantage.
Yeah.
I imagine your parents are the proudest parents out there.
They are.
You obviously haven't been told that it's a crime to be this beautiful and bright.
No, I think there's so many beautiful people who are, I think that's a fallacy that you can't be beautiful and smart. And I'm sure people look at you and they think, oh, she's so dumb, until you open your mouth, and then they think, wow, Sonia's actually smart. It is this, you know, there's this belief that you need to be, if you're really smart, you can't be pretty.
Mm.
You can't be beautiful.
Mm.
And it's actually not the case. I mean, if you look at Michelle Obama, who I idolize, I think she's gorgeous, and she's so, she's 50.
Mm.
And look at her. She looks amazing. And there's so many beautiful people who are super smart.
You're right. You, Phumla Majola-Cohen, and Pamela Pitti have shared stories on what you got up to at St. Cyprian's. Can you share some of those memories? I know some people might not know that you used to jump the wall in boarding school when you were supposed to be studying.
That's them.
And
I was the nerdy one that apparently I told on everyone.
Oh, so you never jumped the walls at night to go look for a party elsewhere?
Never. So there was this big, and I think that there are people who left St. Cyprian's who think that I told on. So a few students at boarding school jumped the walls. They had a guy pick them up to go to a party, and it happened twice. And the second time, a whole host of people got kicked out of school. They were expelled from school. And some were let back. But there were only like two of us or three of us who were there in boarding school. And they then suspected that we were the ones that told. But they forgot that actually there were other students who were not boarders, who were also at these parties, who saw the boarders. And they told on. So I'm certain that till this day there are students who think that I told on.
That you're a snitch.
That I snitched on. And for a long time, it was quite difficult, actually, because even those that came back, they were very mean to me. There was a lot of bullying that happened because they thought that I had snitched. And I didn't even know that this happened, because it happened when we were sleeping.
I know I can only imagine. I can't say I know, because I don't have a PhD. Obtaining it takes dedication, hard work, and perseverance. Tell me about the challenges that you were faced with and that you had to endure to get to actually getting that qualification.
Yeah. So I think it's better when you do it as a married person, or when you have a partner, And I know it's going to sound very strange, but here's the thing. You need that support from someone and someone to encourage you and keep you going. And when you're alone, because I moved to the UK at 24. I didn't know anyone. I left there for 10 years. So no family, no, I had friends initially who were from South Africa, but for the most part, you're studying alone. And so it is very, very lonely. It is also, can get tedious. You have like mental blocks a lot, to the point where you can't even construct one sentence. So you have days where you're supposed to write chapters, but you actually can't even write a sentence. So you are staring into your pages and not doing anything, or staring into a computer and nothing. And all you're doing is looking at your computer and going for a meal and then coming back to stare. So it's a very lonely, you need someone to encourage you, someone to give you reasons to continue. Another thing is that the UK is very expensive. And so, you know, I was one of the poorest students in a very wealthy school. And so I didn't do a lot of what my classmates organized. Like, they'd go for group dinners and group lunches, and my budget wasn't big enough for any of that. Actually, that was the poorest I've ever been. So I, you know, it was to the point where it was either, do I walk or do I take a bus? And then taking a bus means that my lunch will be different. I'm very thankful to the Hare Krishnas, because they used to offer free food on campus. And the food was just, you know, I'm a carnivore. And so Hare Krishnas don't need meat, though it was a lot of vegetables, but it was well cooked. So I survived on Hare Krishna food. And so it was, I guess, life changing and shaping. And you become very humble and you just focus on what you're there to do. Once you start, and it changes so quickly, and you know, you don't believe anyone who says this during that moment. And then once you finish, you are, you know, I worked for Barclays, and you start getting a salary and you start affording some of the luxury goods that you used to walk past or used to try on. You used to go to Selfridges and just try on this very expensive dress and just dream and then take it off and walk out as if, you know. My first, I need to tell you the story. So one of the first stores that I walked into at when I was a student was De Beers. And I walked there, I was very cocky. Not cocky in a bad way, like as in more arrogant and confident. You know, usually when you walk into these stores, they look at you thinking, okay.
Size you are.
Yeah. And I still had like my clothes from South Africa, my winter clothes, which were not sufficient to, you know, warm me up. And so I looked like, I guess I looked, you know, I had this big brown jacket that I bought from Stutterfords back in the days. And then, so I walked in there and the lady like looks at me thinking, okay, you know, give me that look almost as if to say, no beggars are allowed. But I was so confident and cocky because I was thinking, De Beers is like South African. It's like, it's a family business.
Yes.
So, you know, I don't care who you are, but I'm here to check out the family jewels. So I had that. I tried on rings. And I know nothing about diamonds, even to this day. But I tried out all rings, and she was explaining, and I dropped names. I was like, yeah, Jonathan Oppenheimer. And yeah, I'm from South Africa. So she kind of like, you know, then she looked at me like, I don't know who she is. She could be somebody, because she's dropping all the right names.
Yes.
So that was me. Uh-huh. Couldn't even afford not even, I don't know, the smallest item at De Beers, but I managed to do that.
And now you can buy a De Beers franchise if there was one.
Not yet.
Yeah. She's trying to be humble. So tell me, what was your thesis or dissertation on?
So I looked at capital flows and currency crisis in emerging markets. So I've always focused on emerging markets. And because I guess South Africa is also an emerging market, and we compare ourselves to countries that are like us, so Brazil, Chile, Turkey, Russia, China. And at that time, I looked at a lot of the 2001 financial crisis that happened in South Africa, but really a lot of South America, South America, where the epicenter of the crisis was, and we got hit by it. We also had our own issues then that made us very vulnerable to the financial crisis. So I looked at all those, that dynamic, and interestingly, we haven't really come out of, because 2008-09 we had another financial crisis, but this time it was an emerging market one. It was more US, UK, EU, UK crisis, but which impacted on South Africa because of our close ties and linkages with Europe.
Tell me about your support structure. I mean, be it the person that acted as your supervisor during your studies, your study group, etc.
It was very interesting. So I had a lot of friends who were my support structure. But again, you know, you are writing alone, so you can't, it's not a group effort. It's not like an MBA where you're set up in groups to solve an issue or problem. I think I had good friends, but also my resilience. Because even with my parents, I don't think they got it until much later on. So they weren't, and they're far too. So you can only speak to them on the phone. And this was pre-FaceTime. And yes. I mean, it was during Skype days. And my parents didn't understand Skype. And actually in South Africa then, having Wi-Fi was very rare, Wi-Fi at home. So a lot of it was calls, quick calls, because it was very expensive to call South Africa. And so they didn't really get it. And also because they couldn't even get my subject too. I don't even think they know what my topic was. And so they can't even say, you know, why don't you focus on this, or I read something, or here's a literature review. So they were there in terms of just quick messages, but you spend a lot of time alone and kind of pep talking. You know, you just have to tell yourself that you have to pull through, you have to pull through. Your supervisor was always also very supportive, but he's supervising three other students.
Mm.
So, and he's not there to be a nanny. So you either have to, I guess, put your big girl panties on and say, look, I'm going to carry on and keep on moving.
Absolutely. You sit on the management committee at your company.
Yeah.
Tell me about the challenges faced as a young woman in such a high profile, high ranking position in a male dominated industry.
It's always been challenging, and not just in my company, but everywhere else. I think firstly, I always say it is very challenging being a black woman, a black person, a woman,
young,
and also when you're perceived to be younger than you are. That is also my big challenge. I remember when I moved here, I worked for Standard Bank, and my boss then said, don't you want to wear glasses or something to make you look, you know, older than you really, younger than you really are, because no one will believe you at face value. Then I said, no, why? You know, the beauty industry is $1 billion, and people are paying to look younger. And you're telling me that I must make myself look old so that it's palatable for clients, so that clients can feel comfortable with me. So that's always been a challenge. And, you know, it is only when people say to me, it's only when I open my mouth that they believe my age, that usually they don't believe my age until I open my mouth and they realize actually she's not sounding as young as she looks.
Mm.
And then they become comfortable. But it is, you know, as a black woman, there's so much to this. I guess you're always on the battlefield. You always have to make, you know, you're making sure that people are comfortable with you, making sure that you are, people acknowledge that you are smart or believe that you are smart, making sure that you're not a bimbo, and making sure that people don't talk over you, which usually men do. So there's just always, you know, it's always a fight from all fronts. And you just have to keep on going, or else you don't succeed, unfortunately. That's the only way to succeed in this life, is actually to keep on breaking barriers.
And stand your ground.
standing ground, and you may be seen and to be aggressive, and people may be critical, but actually you must stand your ground. And it's not always easy. I've left jobs because they haven't been, you know, I felt that I was either window dressing, or they thought that I'm. So that's another thing that I think it's a South Africa problem currently, because you hear a lot of people saying, we need a woman, we need a woman, we need a woman. We, you know, we need a woman on our board. We need a woman on our. No, you don't need a woman necessarily. You need a smart person, and a smart person comes. Women are smart too. So, you know, rather go with what you need in terms of what addition that person will bring to your company. And rather than just saying you need a woman, because it's almost like you need an ornament. So it's all five guys, and then you need a woman. And that person comes in there and starts speaking, and then suddenly it's like, oh, she speaks. We didn't want her to speak.
It speaks.
Yeah, and then it becomes, you know, headbutting. And I've been in those situations where you're called onto an ESCO or you're invited. And as women, because we haven't been, you know, we all want to sit at the table. We all want to be part of the boys' club. And when it's a big endorsement, because suddenly you're sitting with the boys. But then you also have to ask yourself, what is my contribution to this? You know, am I there to just be a pretty face and to tick the BE score? Or am I there to actually make a contribution? And also, I think it's a woman's responsibility to bring other women there so that it doesn't become you're the only woman, and then they can, you know, the men can just walk all over you or treat you like an ornament. The more we are, the more then men realize that actually we're not just there to be the only woman because they need a woman as a requirement, that you need to have women because women contribute as much, sometimes more than men, because they bring also a different perspective, because they have different also experiences, just like men. And because, you know, studies have been made about how rational women are and how sometimes women take a longer time to interrogate because they want to make sure that something is right, whereas men are very quick to make a decision without actually looking at the pros and cons. Those are very important traits, both of them, because some things need to be interrogated longer, some decisions need to be made quicker. So I think the balance of having both women and men is very advantageous for companies, and many companies don't realize this.
Do you think we'll reach a point in our lifetime where women's salaries match up with their male counterparts or colleagues? I ask because the gender pay gap statistics are alarming, if not shocking.
Yeah. I think, you know, we can only as women talk about it and talk about it and force issues and make sure that we are heard. But it's actually up to men to also say, guys, this is rubbish. We can't have women earn less than us. I say this also with race, that yes, black people, we can talk about it and talk about it and highlight it, but really it's other people, it's, you know, white people who need to say, guys, we need to really be cognizant and aware and sensitive of certain situations. So again, I think that men need to realize the importance of having fairness and equity. You know, it's interesting because we relate, men and women are relate in many instances where, for instance, in marriage, it is important to have both men and women earning a big salary. The household income then increases. The pressure on men to bring home the bacon, so to speak, is reduced. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of good that comes out of having a, you know, equal pay for men and women. It also societally, it then reduces or eradicates this problem of women depending on men, women doing, you know, selling their souls or, you know, doing certain things to attract men so that they can get money. It also then on the men's side, that taking advantage of young women will also be, I don't say eradicated, but at least it will be lessened when a woman knows her position and earns as much as a man does.
You're a high achiever. You're self-made. You are very independent. I imagine you intimidate a lot of men who even just think about asking you out on a date.
Well, the guys that are intimidated are the guys that are not for me, or the guys who are intimidated by me. I think those who are not are more interesting to me, because it speaks to their self-confidence and their self-awareness. Those who are intimidated, it would never work because obviously they are insecure and not self-assured. It'll be easier if I was 23 meeting a guy then, because I had less to offer. Then I'd also be less, I guess when you're younger, you're less, you don't have as many requirements. But I think it actually works perfectly now because I can choose the person who is right for me.
Absolutely.
Rather than settling for someone and having someone, accommodating someone's ego.
Out of desperation.
Yeah.
Or just because other women are married or, you know, they've got partners and all that. Like that. Do you think we will have a female president in our lifetime? And if so, who would you propose as a candidate?
Yeah, you know, I don't think, having a female president is not important to me. Having the best president is important to me, regardless of who it is. So you could get that actually maybe women don't want to be presidents. They want to be CEOs and want to lead certain organizations because there's only one president. And maybe a certain guy or a series of guys want to be and they've groomed themselves to be. To become the president. But if there is a woman who wants to be and has the right characteristics and has what it takes to be a female president, I'm all for that person. But not because of her gender, but what she will offer and whether she's a good fit for the country. It's a difficult one now because I don't know if, you know, apart from the current person or lady who's put her name forward, and that's actually you've got two. That's Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma and Lindi Sisulu, who I don't think personally would be my choice. And here's why: I think that you don't wake up one day and say you want to be a leader, and then put yourself the next day as a candidate, and then you become the president. If you read Obama's story, and if you read great leaders, it is something that they have wanted for a very long time. And so they have made sure that every step they take towards that role is calculated. So from the education to the organizations that they support to the way they conduct themselves, all of that is calculated. So I have a problem with the way, you know, if I'm not happy with the way you've conducted yourself in the past, and I'm not going to say, be happy with just you being then the president just because you've decided or somebody has decided on your behalf that you're the right candidate. Again, so who do I think would be the best candidate given, you know, the first time when Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka became the deputy, I thought that she was a little inexperienced, but again, she was young. And I guess she was also the deputy. But I think she's doing great work at UN Women. And it's also, I mean, she's older now. She's got a PhD. She's dealing with issues that are global. She's interacting with people from all over the world and tackling real tough issues. I think that she's gotten a lot of training in terms of conduct, how do you conduct yourself, talking to people, being influential. I think that she wouldn't make a bad one. But again, we have so many issues here domestically that require a lot. And a smart president or a smart candidate is somebody who will not embarrass us, will steer the ship, but at the same time is aware of their weaknesses and will get the best people around themselves. So if it's Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka, but she's not 100% the person, I think that she exudes a lot of what a leadership is, and she's got a, you know, great mind, but she needs very strong ministers to make sure that we don't go we don't decelerate as an economy or economic growth, that the ship is steered in the right direction.
I'm going to ask you your opinion on the following. First up, Zimbabwe.
Whew. It's been an interesting one to just to follow. Again, I'm very skeptical of people who've both here and in Zimbabwe, actually everywhere in the world, where you haven't stood up against the rot, the political rot. You've been there, enjoyed it, and watched and supported it. And then suddenly it doesn't work for you. You've got your own ambitions and you want the sitting president to go. So the fact that they want Mugabe to go is one thing, but who's going to take over? And given how much decline the country has experienced, you want somebody to turn it around. And that person needs to be extremely strong, a leader, somebody who's supported on the ground, somebody who's trusted, somebody who has their hearts in the right place, and that is dedicated to the people of Zimbabwe. And I'm not getting that from the deputy president or the Emmerson who was removed. So I'm very worried.
Bafana Bafana, I ask because you tweeted, is there a correlation between our football economy and politics? And is the economy greater than politics?
So, you know, Bafana Bafana is disappointing. And I just think that we came from the reason I tweeted that because we were such a great team, football team. Back in the day, during Mandela's time and Thabo Mbeki's first term, we were winning the Africa Cup of Nations. And then the second time we were in the final, and then we were in the semi-final, and then we were nowhere in the competition. Then we couldn't even qualify. Same with the World Cup. It's a little bit different, but I just think that we're not doing the right things. We're not putting enough training. Our guys are not dedicated. Sometimes I just think that, hey, maybe we're good at badminton. And, maybe we need to just focus on something else than soccer. But really, soccer is not our thing, and it's okay.
Your opinion on nationalization of banks and mines?
I don't think that banks should be nationalized. I think that actually there's a lot of talk on it and it's wasted talk and energy. I think that in future banks will be the bricks and mortar banks will not exist. I think that we'll be using our phones to bank. I don't know how many people have actually walked inside a bank in the past, I don't know, year, 6 months to do any transaction because you can all do it on your bank, on your phone and online. So I don't think it's important for our country to have to nationalize banks. And besides, banks are privately owned. So why are you taking something that belongs to someone else and then nationalizing it?
The other one is mines.
Mines. Again, mines are underperforming. They're very expensive to run. Very. They need a lot of capex, which we don't have as a country. So to adopt something that is, you're basically throwing a lot of money in the dark and hoping for a diamond is a waste of money. As a taxpayer, I don't think that is a good way of utilizing my funds.
What is your advice to women who say, I am too pretty for school or I'm too pretty for a job?
I think, pretty is subjective. And pretty fades. And you're pretty for a moment, and you'd be endorsed by your looks by a couple of people. And then what happens when you grow up and you're not the conventional pretty, and then you have to look for a job?
Profound. Now tell me, are you available as a mentor for a girl to shadow you for a day? And if so, can they contact me for a connection? Or are you okay with them reaching out to you via social media?
Definitely.
Like take a girl child to work, for example.
I do that quite a bit.
Okay. Of all your achievements and accolades, and I know there's so many of them, and I know you value each and every one of them, if you could, or if a family member could, as a way of paying tribute to you, what would be engraved on your tombstone?
Firstly, I don't want a tombstone. I want to be cremated, my ashes to be thrown in the sea. Because I don't know what happens with that land. Maybe next thing, with people wanting land, my grave will be in somebody's property. as part of the bathroom. But I'd like, if I had, I would. She lived her life beautifully.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
I like that. I know you have ambitions to enter public office.
Yeah.
Would you consider running for presidency?
Never.
Why
I
not?
Did when I was younger. So I always thought I'm going to be the president. And I guess I said this when Nelson Mandela was the president, because it seemed very attractive and you changed lives and he made people happy and smile. And I guess I was very idealistic, not understanding what it entails to be a president. I think that it'll take a lot out of me. You're constantly tested. And I don't think that's the life that I want to live. You're constantly, you're constantly criticized. And I look at Obama, who I also, he's like my idol, but he was never good enough for everyone. And when he was doing something good, he was never good enough. And I don't know if I'm cut out for that.
I know you enjoy traveling and exploring the world. And I know you
definitely
believe strongly that traveling is the best education.
Yeah.
One city you would never visit again, and one city that's a must visit.
Ooh. I don't have a city that I wouldn't visit again. I loved every place that I've traveled, even the challenges. I've learned so much. And, you know, as an economist, it's weird because, like I said earlier, being an economist is my profession, but at the same time, it's carved who you are, at least it's carved who I am. So I often get into a country and I think, oh, wow, the housing is like this and the poverty level is like this, and why do they do this here and what happened to the development, and they're a rich country, but where's the money? So you kind of look at things from a lens of an economist. Every country I've been to, I'd go there again. One city that stands out for me is Cartagena in Colombia.
Uh-huh.
I loved it. It's just such a, you know when you think of a place and you just smile. Maybe I was very happy when I was there. The streets are, you know, cobble roads, so there's no cars, and especially in the old city, there. All the houses are different, very well painted and different colors. So you can actually stand against a wall and it makes the perfect picture. The food was lovely. The people, beautiful. So that's one place that I really think it stands out. And then my favorite all-time city in the world. If I move to New York, I don't think I'll ever come back. Just warning. Yeah, it's my ultimate favorite.
Lastly, you tweeted, former statistician, it's a mouthful, general, Pali Lehotla, says 60% of men claim to be married versus 30% of women. Does this mean women have left their men without telling them?
Yeah. My tweets will get me in trouble. No, but it was an interesting one because I'm thinking, how do men claim? Firstly, they're more women than men. And 60% of women men claim that they are married. Then what happens? Who are they married to? So, and usually, I don't know, from my experience, men always, even those who are married, don't always want to talk about the fact that they're married. They present themselves as being single. So I just thought that was a very interesting statistic.
I love your social media interaction. I mean, you crack me up. I mean, you, like I said, you're a breath of fresh air. Dr. Tabi Leoka, it was an honor having you on the Opinion Booth.
Thank you so much. It's lovely being here finally. And it's always nice to be interviewed by someone you know.
I know. That's why I'm like, oh, no, I know her. You know, I just gave her a call and she agreed to be my guest. You know, that's how I roll. People in high places, you know, levels. Now I'm name dropping, right? My humble opinion, after all, this is the Opinion Booth. If I had a daughter, I'd hope and pray she chooses you as someone to look up to, as a mentor and role model. Women of your caliber should be celebrated, and that's why you're here. You're an exceptional human being.
Thank you.
And I'm truly honored to have met your kind in my lifetime.
I'm humbled.
I'm tearing up now. You are inspiration personified, and people who have the opportunity to be in your circle who don't embrace or acknowledge the brilliance that you are, it would be such a great pity, because often we celebrate mediocrity.
We do.
Someone like you, you should be the person that gets millions of followers because you've got so much to offer the world. In the words of Marilyn Ferguson, achievers have an enabling attitude, realism, and a conviction that they themselves were the laboratory of innovation. Their ability to change themselves is central to their success. They have learned to conserve their energy by minimizing the time spent in regret or complaint. Every event is a lesson to them. Every person, a teacher. Aspire to inspire before you expire.
Oh, thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.